Okay, chapter 4, coming at it from the overview standpoint, remember it is focusing around the concept of rest. And the first part talks about the life of rest in chapter 4, verses 1 through 10. Then, as soon as that is covered, you begin in verse 11 to center about a command concerning rest in 11 through 13, verse 11. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest. And notice this is all revolving about command. And then finally, in verse 14, you come to our high priest of rest. 4:14 through 16. All right, and that's where we're ready to start with tonight. So let's look at the high priest of rest. This is the major doctrine of Hebrews, is the high priesthood of Christ. And we'll look tonight at verses 14 through 16. And again, three parts, reading the verses. First of all, the emphasis will be on the character of our high priest. Verse 14. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. And the emphasis is on the greatness of him or his character. Then in verse 15, the key thought is the idea of the empathy of our high priest. Verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. And then in verse 16, the key idea is the sufficiency of our high priest. He's adequate for us. And therefore we read, let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So there are the three things we'll be focusing on tonight. And number one is the character of our high priest. Chapter 4, verse 14. And we will subdivide that into several things. First of all, his position. His position is expressed in verse 14 as high priest. Now, when we talk about high priest, which is, incidentally, in Greek, only one word, simply the word for priest, we can say several things about it. In the first place, the book of Hebrews is the only place in the New Testament where the expression high priest is applied to Christ. So let's put only in Hebrews. In other words, if we omit a study of Hebrews, we will never grasp what it is for Christ to be our high priest. The second thing we should say about that is, in talking about the high priesthood of Christ, is the method of teaching that Hebrews uses more than any book of the New Testament. The method of teaching truth is by analogy. Analogy means you teach the unknown by the known. You teach the unknown by the known. We do this a lot of times if we say, did you know such and such person? And they say, no, I don't think I know them. Who are they? And you begin to explain who they are by analogy. And what will you do? You say, well, he's about Fred's size and about her build and so forth. What you're doing, well, that wouldn't be a very good description. But you know what I mean, anyhow. And the idea is you take the known and you teach the unknown by it. The unknown in Hebrews that is being communicated is the high priesthood of Christ. And the known is what? The known in the book of Hebrews, you can keep it in mind if you'll simply remember a little acronym. The analogies teaching about the priesthood of Christ in the book of Hebrews are STP. Sacrifices, tabernacle, and priesthood. And therefore, when we come into the book, he is going to say, I will take the Old Testament sacrifices, that's what you all know about, and I will teach you what you don't know about Christ by referring to those sacrifices. And I will go back to the tabernacle that you do know about, and I will teach you things that you do not know about the person of Christ by means of reference to the tabernacle, which you're acquainted with. And I will teach you what we know about the person of Christ. I'll get that done by going back to the Old Testament priest, which you all know about. Now, we stress something there, that the readers of the book of Hebrews would be well acquainted with the sacrifices and the tabernacles and the priesthood. Why? They were Jews. They had seen, they understood these things, they knew what a priest did. They knew how he functioned, and this is the information that is going to be used in order to communicate truth to us concerning Christ. Now, what problem does that have for us? What problem? The problem that's got for us is, what do we know about the sacrifices, the tabernacle, and the priesthood? How well acquainted are we with it? And for that reason, we will be spending some time going back into the Old Testament to Leviticus and so forth to get some background. But keep in mind, the method of the book of Hebrews is going to be teaching by analogy, learning the unknown by means of reference to the known. All right? The next stress is something about our high priest, his character, or his nature. His position, high priest, and we'll be developing that up through chapter 5. Remember what happens in Hebrews all the way through is that the author will teach, and then he will notice that the first three rows have fallen asleep and fallen out of their chairs. Then he will give a little sermon to wake them up and get them all awake again, and then he will go back and teach them more doctrine. And then after some of the teaching of the doctrine, they begin to fall off their chairs again, and he has to come on and wake them all up. Now, we have just been to a section that has been designed to wake us up. It started back in chapter 3, and it comes down through chapter 4, verse 13. With verse 14, we now come back to teaching. And that will go through the rest of chapter 4 into chapter 5. And where do we get our next break? Where do we get awakened next? They do quite well up through verse 10, which says, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And from the back row, you hear the snores. And so he stops, sets the teaching aside, and in verse 11 says, concerning him we have much to say, hard to explain, since you have become dull of hearing. And he begins in the following verses to wake them up and say in chapter 6, let's get moving again on. So we're ready now to pick up a section that is going to be dealing with the key topic of the book of Hebrews, which is the high priesthood of Christ. Now, when we get his nature, in verse 14, it says we have a great high priest. Unfortunately, when you take superlatives and overuse them, they lose their meaning. We have done that. Everything is what? Fantastic. Super. Colossal. That's old, I guess. But those words get used so often, and so often we're told that something is fantastic when it isn't, that the words begin to lose their edge. And therefore, when you put the word great beside the word fantastic, how does the word great seem? Sign of anemic, doesn't it? Well, we shouldn't let it have that force in this verse. Be sure we give it its full force. Since then, we have a great high priest. And the idea there will be he is infinitely great. He is infinitely above all other high priests. Infinitely above all others. And that is carried by the weight of the word, he is great. All right? Now, what is it that has made him great? And this is number 3, or his work. And notice how that is explained in verse 14. Since then, we have a great, that is his nature, high priest, that is his position, and we'll be learning lots more about that. Now, what has he done? He has passed through the heavens, and that is talking about his work. Now, as is going to be true over and over again in the book of Hebrews, when he talks about passing through the heavens, his mind is in the Old Testament. And what we see here is pictured on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, Leviticus 16, rather, which we often call the Day of Atonement, the Hebrew words for Day of Atonement, on Yom Kippur, this was the one day of the year when the sins of the whole nation were expiated once and for all, at least until the next year. And on that day, the priest took a special trip. The trip or the journey that the high priest took on the Day of Atonement is analogous to the ascension of Christ, and I think you'll see it as we draw it out. Let's go back and put down what happened on Yom Kippur. And we're getting a top side of the tabernacle and the inner workings here. Okay. Here is your first veil, your second veil. And basically here was the altar, should be square, at the outside. Okay, with this in the normal operations, this was the presence of God. On the mercy seat between the cherubim is where God was. This curtain essentially said, keep out. Never, 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 never does an Israelite enter beyond that veil, except one time per year the priest makes a trip, and he starts right out here at this point at the altar. He goes in the first veil, and then he goes in the second veil right into the presence of God. So the journey was from the altar to the presence of God, the place where the sacrifice was made, into the presence of God. And he did this only once per year under very, very, very special conditions could this be done. Just to show how this excluded people from the presence of God, let's put in here in the holy place, is one man, the high priest, got to go in there once a year. Who got to go in out here? How'd you qualify? To go in out here in the holy place, you had to be a priest. And where was the rest of Israel? The rest of Israel was out here. So if you happened to be a priest in Israel, you would get in here, but only one out of the priesthood ever got to go in here. In other words, he was a very exceptional man. This would be Aaron or his successors. And therefore, on the Day of Atonement, that was the trip that he made. He would come out here, he would make a sacrifice at the altar, and then he would go within the first veil into the holy place, and then he would go behind the second veil into the place where the presence of God was, and he would place blood on the mercy seat. Okay, now that is what happened on the day of Jesus' ascension. And what we ought to do mentally is this. Take the tabernacle, stand it up on end, put the altar down here on the Mount of Olives, and as he ascends in the Mount of Olives, he ascends from the place of his sacrifice into the presence of God. Now notice the way that is stated in verse 14. Since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens. Notice what is being said here. It does not say he passed into heaven. It says he passed through heavens. So the idea is journey through something that took place. And therefore, if we want to see that, let's go to Acts chapter 1 and notice what happens when he made the journey from the Mount of Olives into the presence of God. Yom Kippur, or what the priest did on that day, is made parallel to the ascension of Christ. So let's just put it, parallels the ascension. Or looking from the Old Testament standpoint, it prefigured the ascension. Okay, in Acts chapter 1, notice we're on the Mount of Olives, and in verse 9 it says, and after he had said those things, he vanished. No. After he had said those things, he disappeared. No. He did not disappear. He did not vanish. What happened? His bodily presence simply went out of sight. So, verse 9, after he had said these things, he was lifted up while they were looking on, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And so if you want to picture what happened on the day of ascension, Jesus Christ is there with the disciples, and he begins to ascend. And he gets higher and higher and higher, and they begin to strain and strain and strain until pretty soon they say he is out of the range of vision. All right? If we would take this then, upend it, here is the Mount of Olives, and on that day, what did he do? He went out of their sight, and when he went out of their sight, where did he go? Chapter 8 of Hebrews. Chapter 8 shows where he went at the end of the journey. He ended up the same place that the high priest ended up on the Day of Atonement, the presence of God. And so notice in chapter 8 of Hebrews, we have the following. Now the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. So what happened on that day is that he disappeared out of their sight and took his seat at the right hand of the Father. By the way, Christ is always seated in the book of Hebrews. And he's always pictured as seated at the Father's right hand. So can you see the analogy? On the Yom Kippur, you made the blood sacrifice at the altar. Then the priest took it and went in and delivered the blood over here to the Ark of the Covenant between the cherubim on the mercy seat and took it into the presence of God. What did Christ do on the Day of Atonement? He left this earth. He sat down at the right hand of the Father on high, and what does he have there to hold before him that's the basis of our forgiveness? His own death and his own shed blood. So the priest took the blood off of the place where the sacrifice for sin was made, took it in, put it in the presence of God. And that's exactly what you've got on the Day of Ascension for Christ. Now let's make, drawing out parallels, let's say, why is Ascension, the Day of Ascension, important? What is important about it? We know if we'd ask why is the cross important, it's important simply because that was where sin was paid for. We know why the resurrection was important. The resurrection was God the Father saying, I accept the work of Christ and it's completely adequate. What's the ascension for? Why is it important? Two things we need to say about it. Number one, the ascension shows the value of the cross in the eyes of God. It's God the Father saying, you can have a seat right here at my right hand because what you did on that cross is adequate. So the ascension shows the value of the cross. And second, the ascension is humanity's greatest day. Or let's put, it's humanity's first. And what is it a first for with humanity? It is a first from the standpoint, this is the day on which the first member of the human race walked into the presence of God on the basis of his own personal merits. May I repeat that? This is humanity's first because it is the first and only time that a person who was a human being, and of course deity at the same time, who was a human being on the basis of his own life, works, death, burial, resurrection, and on the basis of his own merits, walks up to the throne of God, and God says, I'm satisfied. Sit down. And therefore, it's a tremendously important day because it does show that there is now a man in heaven. That's an important. There is now a man in heaven. And the book of Hebrews is going to say something more about that, is that that man is a representative man, there to represent us as our high priest. So that is the importance, great importance of the ascension. All right, now let's look at the empathy of our high priest. His character, now his empathy. And that is in Hebrews 4:15. And the first thing we need to state is that verse 15 is going to say that he can and does enter our testing. So let's simply make that as a statement. He personally enters our testings. He personally enters our tests. Verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. So notice the emphasis is he sympathizes with us. The word for sympathize in Greek looks like this. It is sympatheo. Sympatheo. What have our translators done with the word sympatheo? What have they done with it? Have they translated it? No. Anytime you say the word sympathy, you're saying a Greek word. It's not translated. You're speaking Greek. And the important thing is to get the basic distinction involved in this word is the idea does not mean to feel for another person. So let's put what it does not mean. It does not mean to feel for another. But it means to feel with another. Get the distinction we're trying to make? It means much more than to feel for another person. It means you actually get in on what they're going through. And the emphasis is we have a high priest in heaven who not just looks down and says, I feel sorry for you. He says, I feel with you. He enters in a very real way. And I don't think our English word sympathy gets that at all. Now, why is he able to enter in our feelings? Why is he able to sympathize with us? How does he qualify? Well, he qualifies because he has been tested. So, question, how does he qualify to feel for us? And the answer to that is he also has been tempted. All right, now we need to be very careful with the wording of verse 15, reading it. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted. All right, now there the word we need to do some work with. He has been tempted. And we need to say two things about he has been tempted. The first one is simply grammatical information that is important, and that is this is a perfect tense. And perfect tense carries two ideas with it. The first idea of perfect tense is obviously completed action. In other words, the action in the word tempted is all over with. And what that means is that while he lived on earth and was tempted, he is not being tempted now. It's all history. In other words, the temptation of Christ that he experienced on this earth is all history. The second idea coming out of a perfect tense is not just completed action, but lasting results or abiding results. Whenever you have a perfect tense, you've got those two ideas. So what is the point? He has lived and died, and his testing during his some 33 years on earth is all finished. It's all done. It is all complete. And the fact that this happened to him has what? It has lasting results. And what are the lasting results? The lasting results are he is able to be sympathetic with us as believers. Now, when we talk about him being tempted, let's do something about and with the scope of his testing. And break it down into categories. First of all, he had pressures from the world. And we'll subdivide that and look at passages. Humanity as a whole, and his own nation, and his friends. We want to see the scope of his suffering and the first grouping will be look at the pressures that he got from being in this world. And let's look at a passage for each. John 15. The net result of these next few minutes ought to be, we will say, nobody has ever suffered like he suffered. And I hope it will also make us feel ashamed that we ever, ever complain about suffering. We don't know what suffering is compared to his. Humanity at large, John chapter 15, verses 18 through 25. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. Very, very clear-cut teaching. If you are of the world would love its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So notice the emphasis in these verses is simply on the fact that the world hated him. So did his own nation. John 8, 41. Try and stay close here. John 8, 41. Notice the cutting words from his own Jewish people. They're talking about their connection to Abraham. In verse 41 it says, "You are doing the deeds of your father," and they, the nation, the Jewish nation, says to him, "We are not born of fornication. We have one Father, even God." You can also add with that, John 1:11, "He came into his own, and his own received him not." He also had pressure from friends. Matthew 16. Verses 21 through 23. Friends who were in many times the embodiment of Satan toward him. And here's a case with Peter. 16:21. "From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things of the elders, the chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised on the third day. And Peter, his friend, took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'God forbid it, Lord, this shall never happen to you.'" And notice he immediately identified the fact that a friend was being used by Satan as his spokesman. And you get that in verse 23. "He turned and said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you're not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's.'" And he suffered at the hands of those kind of friends. And why would that be by so cutting to him? His food, he says, was to do the will of God. And here is not only the nation and humanity, but one of the disciples himself putting pressure on him. Second, there were not only pressures from this world, but he also had pressures from the spirit world. Pressure from the spirit world. For that, Luke 22:53. We're in the context of the crucifixion, and he notes what is happening at this time. 22:53, when he said, "While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours." So at this hour of his crucifixion, you have the spirit world harassing him. Third, he had pressures from God the Father. Pressures from God the Father. One of the most remarkable verses I know of, Isaiah 53 and verse 10. And again, this is within the context of the crucifixion. Chapter 53, verse 10. "But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief, if he would render himself as a guilt offering." Startling words. It pleased the Lord to crush him, putting him to grief. Anyone know, everyone had God the Father been crushed by God the Father? He did. And this is the scope of his suffering. And therefore, if we cannot say we've been disciplined, of course, but if we cannot say that in living a perfectly righteous life, we were crushed by God the Father, then we do not experience and know the scope of the suffering that he experienced. All right, fourth. Pressure from his own knowledge. Pressure from his own knowledge. Have you ever stopped to think how terrible it would be to be omniscient? Would you like to know everything that people feel about you? Would you like to know that? One of the very gracious things that God has blessed us with is that I don't always know what you think of me, and I'm glad, because I know you probably have some thoughts sometime that are not good, and the reason I know that is because I have thoughts about you. Okay. Mark 10:32. says they were on the road going to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him. And what would it require to be able to do that? He knew exactly what was going to happen at Jerusalem. It was not a surprise. He knew it ahead of time. Wouldn't that be pressure? To know the kind of horrible death you're going to die and the details of it. That was a pressure, and that's part of the scope of his suffering. Fourth, that's all. That's good enough. Now, go back to Hebrews 4 and notice what was the result of all of this. Of all of this load, if we were doing math, I'd put a line across it, total up what all of these pressures did to him, and then summarize it by Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet, and what's the total of all of this? Total all of these things up, all of these pressures, and you total them up with the words, without sin. Without sin. Okay, now when we talk about his being sympathetic as a high priest with us, and I think it'd be well to, I'm going to take time to write this out, because this is something to think about. Sympathy with the sinner does not depend on the experience of sin. Sympathy with sinners does not depend on the experience of sin. He doesn't have to sin like we sin in order to be sympathetic. Sympathy with sinners does not depend on the experience of sin. Now let's say what it does. Sympathy with sinners rests on the strength of the temptation. I'll not write all of that out, but just the part that's relevant. Sympathy with sinners does not depend on the experience of sin. It depends on the strength of the test. Can I put it a different way? The person that yields to sin does so before he feels the full pressure of it. And I hope I'm not overworking the illustration, but I think it does express the idea. If you wanted to know and feel the weight of 2,000 pounds on your shoulders, we've got it suspended, and you begin to lower it with a chain, and you're standing on scales, let's say, and it's lowered on, and you're now holding 100 pounds worth of it, and then a little more is let down, and now you've got 200 pounds worth, and then 300, and then 400, and finally, at 400 pounds, you collapse. Do you know what 2,000 pounds feels like? No. You only know what 400 pounds, because you didn't make it through to have the whole load put down on your shoulders. All right, the same thing is true with respect to Christ. Have we ever felt the full load of a test? What usually happens to us before we feel a full load of tests? We collapse, don't we? And what he's saying is there is one man, to go back to our 2,000 pounds, there is one man that knows what 2,000 pounds of weight feels like. Why? Because he carried it and didn't collapse. Okay, and that is what is emphasized here, is that he has experienced it fully because he did not collapse in it. All right? Finally, in verse 16, the sufficiency of our high priest. Verse 16. First of all, in going to verse 16, what word do you know that I'm going to mention? Probably first. Let us, therefore. Okay. The word therefore is an important one in this verse, because it is the word that links practice and doctrine. It's the word that links practice and doctrine. The doctrine is we have a high priest that he's taught about in verses 14 and 15. Now, what ought we to do? What ought we to practice in the light of that doctrine. So it's simply going to say, all right, I want to take you by the hand now and show you how this applies. So notice the wording. Let us therefore draw near. The word draw near is used several times in the book of Hebrews. Let me tell you several things about it. In the first place, the Septuagint translation, that's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, uses this word in a technical way. It's used for the approach that the priest made. Used for the approach of a priest. And when the priest, for example, took the blood and he went into the holy place, or when the high priest took the blood and he went into the presence of God, the word that is here was for his activity of coming near like a priest. For example, let me show it to you three other places. Verse 25 of chapter 7. Chapter 7 says, hence also he is able to save forever those who draw near. And for draw near, think of the activity of the Old Testament priest when he came into the presence of God. Draw near to God through him. Chapter 10 and verse 22. Exhortation, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith. And then in chapter 12, verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion, or drawn near to Mount Zion. So we'll have a lot about the fact that we can draw near in the Old Testament. All right, second thing. When we do draw near, what attitude do we draw near with? Well, notice this is to be accompanied with and done with confidence. The Greek word parousia is very interesting. Here's what it means literally. It means to give utterance to every thought. To give utterance to every thought, literally. It is holding back nothing. Therefore, in verse 16, let us draw near, giving utterance to every thought. And what is that based upon? We have a high priest who is sympathetic with us. The word is used for being bold. It's used for being frank. It's used for being outspoken. And therefore, he says, draw near to him and be bold. Be frank. Be outspoken. Let me give you a little usage of it. Go to, for example, Mark 8:32. I want to get the flavor of the attitude with which we are to approach him. Mark 8:32. And you'll get the flavor. Look at what happens in the context, and then remember this is the way to relate to God into his presence. 8:32. It says, and he was stating the matter plainly. And there are your words. Stating the matter plainly are the words used in Hebrews chapter 4 that says we are to come with confidence. And notice here, he stated matters very plainly is a good expression of it. John 7, verse 13. We're down at the Feast of Tabernacles. And instead of, they were all whispering. And in verse 13 it says, yet no one was speaking openly. And the word speaking openly are the same as the word confident. So notice the idea of frankness, openness is involved in the word. Chapter 10 of the same book in verse 24. Chapter 10:24 reads, the Jews therefore gathered around him and were saying to him, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us. And there's the word, plainly. Acts 4:13. Taking a little time with the word because it has to do with our attitude coming in before the throne of grace. Chapter 4, verse 13. it says, now as they observed, and here's our word, the confidence of Peter and John. So it's in the idea of boldness. So going back to Hebrews then, chapter 4. Let us, therefore, in the light of the fact he's a sympathetic high priest, approach him telling everything with confidence and boldly to the throne of grace. All right, now there's where we are to go, and we want to do a little word with what is involved in the throne of grace. What is it? Now, remember, when Christ, when the book, the author of Hebrews is talking about Christ being a high priest, keep in mind that to the Jewish mind, Jesus Christ contradicted everything in their mind about what a priest would do. For example, just think of the Jewish priest that they had known about from the Old Testament. First of all, if you're going to be a priest, you had to be the house of Aaron, right? As a priest, you operated where? In the temple. As a priest, you did priestly duties. You made sacrifices and so forth, which would be priestly duties. And fourth, where were the chairs in the tabernacle? There was no place to sit. There was no seating for the priest. Priests did their work standing up. You didn't have a picture of a priest sitting in a chair beside the altar. All of their work was done while on their feet. The author of Hebrews comes along and says, Jesus is your high priest. And the Jew would scratch his head and say, how in the world could he be? Tribe of Aaron? No. Operate in the temple? Jesus never entered the temple. He entered the courtyard, but as far as the temple where the priests were, he never set foot inside of it once in the New Testament. And he's a priest? Have you ever seen him offer a sacrifice? Did he make sacrifices? No. And now you come along and you've got the priest where? Sitting down on a throne. And so they would naturally scratch their heads and say, well, if he is a priest, he is unlike any priest that we have ever known. And the author of Hebrews is going to say, you bet he is. And he's going to explain what those differences are. All right, the idea then is in verse 16 is that he sits on a throne of grace. And as we said earlier, Christ is always sitting in the book of Hebrews. Now, when we talk about this being a throne of grace, what does that mean? Well, it simply means that grace is God's operating principle. That's the way he operates. And let me give some other options. And just diagram each. For example, let's put God up here and man down here, and we will have what we call the debt principle. And that would be God looking at man, sees his merits, and rewards it. Second, here is God, and we'll call this the leniency principle. God looks down and he sees man is miserable. And looking down and seeing that he is miserable, he dispenses blessing to him because of his mercy. Or we could put it this way. The first one looks at merit and rewards it. The second one looks at misery and rewards anyway. We could illustrate the first one. We operate all day long on that. What if you're employed, what is the principle on which you and your employer relate? Well, you work for 40 hours, and at the end of, let's say, 40 hours, the employer is indebted to you, and he relieves his indebtedness with a paycheck. Then what do? You start it all over again. And you put him in debt for 40 hours work, and he relieves his indebtedness with a paycheck. Many, many people think the way God plays that way. You know, God will look down and he will count the Sunday school pens, the checks that you put in an offering plate, total them up, and at the end of life will write you out a check of eternal life. Some, thank God, operates on the leniency principle. This is a guy that normally works 40 hours a week, but on Thursday morning he's sick. And he is out of work on Thursday and Friday, and his employer says, well, you only work 24 hours, but I see how miserable you are. I'm going to pay you full. And some people think God will do that way. God will say, you be holy as I am. And man looks back and says, I tried very hard. And God says, well, granted, you tried very hard, and I feel sorry for you, so I'll grant you eternal life. That is not the way it works. The third principle is, again, grace. And grace is simply, here is man as a miserable sinner. And here is the cross of Christ. And God looks over here and sees the merits of the person on the cross, and as a result of his merits, dispenses blessing to this man. So the fourth, the grace principle, looks at Christ and blesses man on his merits. All right, now let's go back to the text and observe three things coming out of it, or two things rather. Notice that you got a double blessing of the grace throne. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace. And notice the double blessing involves two things. Number one, when we come to the throne of grace, it is effective. Verse 16, latter part, that we may receive mercy and may find grace. By the way, the word find is an important word because it is a word that means discovery based on investigation. It means discovery based on investigation. So, verse 16, we may find through investigation grace to help. We had that word previously. The word help, remember, bought a theo, split in half. Bought a means to cry. Theo means to run. It means to run to someone's cry with help. So in verse 16, we may find by discovery grace that responds to our cry. And then notice, not only is it effective, it is timely. The expression grace to help in time of need, the word time of need means well timed, comes just at the right time. Do you ever sit down and think about certain things, if they would happen to you now, you back off and say, I couldn't handle it, no way? And you know what? That's true. Because God does not give grace to meet a crisis until it's there. And the promise involved is, there's nothing spiritually weak about looking at a certain situation and say, well, you know, at this moment, if I had to go through that, there's no way I could do it. I could not handle it. I would collapse. And that's true. But the promise of this verse is God dispenses from his throne of grace the response to your cry at the right time, when you need it, not when. In other words, God gives the grace to die when it's time to die. He does not give it ahead of time. And that is important because I think so often, you look at certain situations in life and feel like, well, I couldn't handle it, and feel guilty about that because we should be able to handle it, but that's not the case. We will, and that is the promise that is involved here in the 16th verse. All right, next week we will start into chapter 5, verses 1 through 10, and by the time we get to 10, the Hebrew believers will have gone to sleep again, and we'll wake them up in verse 11, but we'll be basically be looking at two things. The priest of the Old Testament compared with the priesthood of Christ. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word. We're thankful that you have empathy with us. May we recognize that there is no situation in which we find ourselves that you do not understand, because you have felt enormous pressures in your earthly life. And we're thankful that that man who bore them all completely and adequately has sympathy with us, and he has a throne. He's sitting down, and it is called the throne of grace. We give you thanks for this in Christ's name tonight. Amen.